feathered bachelorhood okay this week? No, I didn't think so. At least I didn't have to worry about my hair being combed. I give ladies a hard time, so men, it's your morning. Ladies, you should enjoy this. What do men really mean when they say, I'm going fishing? Well, usually they mean, I'm going to go eat and drink too much, stand by a stream with a stick in my hand and as the fish swim by in complete safety. What does a guy mean when he says, can I help with dinner? It means, why isn't it already on the table? When a man says, uh-huh, sure, honey, or yes, dear, what does that really mean? It really means absolutely nothing. It's a conditioned response. Somebody on the front's clearing their throat down here. What does it mean when a man says it would take too long to explain? He means I have no idea how it works. What does a man mean when he says, that's interesting, dear? Not, that's close. It actually means, are you still talking? What does it mean? Oh, don't make such a big fuss. I just cut myself. It's no big deal. It means I've actually severed a limb, but I will bleed to death before I admit I'm hurt. What does it mean when a guy says, hey, I've got my reasons for what I'm doing? It actually means I sure hope I think of one pretty soon. What does it mean, ladies, when a man says, I can't find it? It means it didn't fall into my outstretched hands, so I'm completely clueless. That's true. That is true. What does it mean when a man says, I heard you? It means I have the foggiest clue what you just said, and I'm hoping desperately that I can fake it well enough so that you don't spend the next 3 days yelling at me. What does it mean when a guy says, you know, I could never love anyone else? This is a joke, right? He actually means I'm used to the way you yell at me and realize it could be worse. It's a joke, okay? What does it mean when he says, you look terrific? It means, please don't try on another outfit. I'm starving. Oh, and finally, no, not finally, two more. I'm not lost. I know exactly where we are. It means actually no one will ever see us alive again. And finally, we share the housework. It means I make the messes and she cleans them up. All right, we're in Matthew 24. Matthew 24. All right, Matthew 24. We keep finding ways to chase rabbits in this chapter, and you know, really, they're not rabbits. We've just spent quite a while here trying to make sure they work with that. We work through things methodically and all. And this will be no exception here this morning. Going to start right off with, some people would call it rabbit chasing, I guess. Notice now, we've come down through the beginning of Matthew 24 and gone through a whole bunch of stuff already about the Great Tribulation. The issue here is the disciples are asking, when's the end of the world going to be? The end of the world is understood to be the end of this world as we know it. That is, at the end of the Great Tribulation, the Lord Jesus Christ comes back and sits down on the throne in Jerusalem and sets up the world to come, a new world, all right? Prophetically, that's what it's talking about. It's not talking about nuclear meltdown or environmental catastrophe, that kind of thing. It's not what it's talking about. And so this whole thing, basically all of Matthew 24, prophetically, is about things that are going to happen in the Great Tribulation after the church is out of here, after we're gone. Now, among other things that it mentions, notice verse 36, we got down this far, that last week. It says, but of that day and hour knoweth no man. Now, that day and hour is specifically, we know that no man does, by the way, know the day or hour of the rapture. We know the times and seasons, Paul says, and we can see that things are coming to pass, but we don't know the day or the hour. But more specifically, this passage is still talking about the day and the hour when Jesus Christ will come again at the second coming, not the rapture, at the second coming at Armageddon. We still don't know the day or hour. All right, that's specifically what he's talking about. And he goes on to say, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. We'll come back and hit this in a minute, but I wanted to hit something else here. Verse 37. But as the days of Noe were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noe entered into the ark. Knew not until the flood came, took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Talking about the second coming of Christ at Armageddon. Okay. Now, I wanted to take a little while because I don't know what you have. We don't have cable at our house, so I don't get the Discovery Channel or Animal Planet or anything like that. But I know enough, I've been in motels enough and here or there enough to know that uniformly, if you're watching even that, what you're watching is evolutionary material. You are watching maybe it's important to begin by saying that there's something these days, it's called uniformitarian geology, okay? And what uniformitarianism is basically evolution. Uniformitarianism believes, a geologist and most of the geologists, I can promise you that everybody that probably teaching science and biology for the most part at the U of M is uniformitarian. What that means, folks, is that they believe that through the ages that everything has continued as it was from the beginning of the creation, and things have just eased along and eked along uniformly without any great worldwide catastrophes or anything like that that would disturb the geological evidence and all that, and that layer after layer after layer after layer of rock was laid, and billion years, millions and millions and millions of years, one life form after another has built upon another. It's basically evolution. It's the idea that in order to get where we are, we evolved without God by chance, by miraculous features of Mother Nature, and it took us 570 or 600 million years, depending on who you believe, to get here. Okay? That's uniformitarianism. Now, catastrophism is another form of geology that basically is founded basically on the Bible. And that idea is that the rocks and fossils and all that stuff are basically revolve around the fact that the earth has had gigantic upheavals through the years, and not the least of which is Noah's flood. And that the fossil record and that the geological record as such is attributable to that more than actually billions of years of evolution. And, you know, at first, you know, we were non-organic somethings or other, and then gradually worked up to paramecians and one-celled organisms, and up from there, up through, and so on and so forth. Like I said, if you go to med school, for the most part, Brother Chris can probably testify to nursing school, fulfilling any kind of requirements for pre-med, pre-physical therapy, anything like that, you're going to be immersed in uniformitarianism. Basically evolution. Now the reason I bring all this up, this may seem strange to have come up out of Matthew 24, but you'll notice that in Matthew 24, the passage that we just read, 36, 37, 38, has to do with Noah. The flood of Noah winds up being one of the great things rotate around as far as this matter is concerned, and basically it's a sign much spoken against. Nobody at the U of M that's teaching paleontology or geology believes the Bible. At best, if there is any truth in Noah, it was some allegorical type deal. Okay. Now, I thought that it would be worthwhile, and I figure that most of you probably read, I hope you read your Bible and you come to church and all that, but chances are pretty good you get exposed to a fair amount just reading newspapers, if nothing else, reading this or that. And if you, like I said, do watch the Discovery Channel, and if you do watch PBS, and if you do watch Animal Planet, you are going to be brainwashed, or the attempt will be to brainwash you into basically believing uniformitarianism, and that we all came from a common life form. We all have the same great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, as do monkeys and lungfish and frogs and, you know, shellfish and everything else. We all came out of the same spot. Now, believe it or not, in spite of the fact, there's one thing that should be stated to start with. The theory of evolution is just that. It's a theory. Now, it's not commonly said anymore. Nowadays, people just tend to say, well, you know, evolution. It's a theory at very best, and a bad theory at that, if you believe the Bible at all. And for that matter, if you love the truth and actually do some reading, besides just, you know, or hearing, just besides what comes across on PBS or what comes across on some special on the news, you learn that there is more scientific evidence, believe it or not, for creationism than there is for evolution uniformitarianism. And I thought I would I'd go through some of this for you. And the stuff that I'm going to read is all over. One of the men that's written real prolifically about this stuff is a guy named Henry Morris. He's put out all sorts of creation material. A lot of the stuff is real good. There are some things that I disagree with him about as far as Bible teaching exposition. But as far as some of those things are concerned, as far as Noah's flood, brother, the evidence is actually staggering. I thought it'd be interesting for you. This would be a real neat counterpoint, believe it or not, for the stuff that kids get if they go to school and when they go to college and so on and so forth. First of all, let me talk to you for just a little while about the whole idea of fossils, okay? I don't know if you realize it or not, but the fossil record presents yet another serious problem for evolutionary uniformitarianism. Large-scale fossilization is not occurring anywhere in the world today. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but what happens, folks, what happens when a fish dies, when a possum dies, when an armadillo dies, do you even know what that is? When a horse dies, when a dog dies, you know, so on and so forth. In nature, what happens? When the fishies in the sea die, what happens? Well, they either get gobbled up or they rot or whatever. Fossilization is not occurring anywhere in the world. You say now, well, it is occurring. It's just such a slow process. No, things rot before that slow process can take effect. And yet, you understand at the same time that there are places on this earth where the fossil record, and I'm, you know, if you, there's just, you know, I'm not a reader of geology, paleontology, that kind of stuff particularly, but I know this. You go to the Grand Canyon stands as one of the great monuments to, you know, the fossil record and strata, because you can get out in the canyon and see all these strata in this rock that were supposed to be laid down through, you know, hundreds of millions of years, even billions of years. Interestingly enough, around this globe, there are places where there is a solid mile deep of a fossil record, fossilization. And yet, at the same time, folks, there is no fossilization occurring. I don't know if you know it or not, but all fossils, for the most part, are found in something called sedimentary rock, as opposed to igneous rock or something like that. You know what sedimentary rock is? Sedimentary rock is rock that's basically laid down, basically a sand and sediment, by a lot of water moving or staying, and it settles out and eventually in time becomes rock. Essentially, all the fossil record is contained in sedimentary rock. Where does sedimentary rock come from? How does something, an allosaur, a stegosaurus, how does it die? And how is it that it dies and its bones are preserved in a sedimentary rock that takes millions of years to lay down? Bones rot too, man. They get dragged around, and yet you have you know, to hear folks, you have these dinosaurs, these remains that are, you know, becoming, you know, discovered more and more. How does that work? Well, it's very little known that the fossil record, that when a fish dies, it doesn't sink to the bottom and become a fossil. It either decomposes or is destroyed by scavengers. Similarly, there is hardly a trace left of the millions of buffalo carcasses which were slaughtered all over the plains only two generations ago. Where are the buffalo fossils? Okay, now how do you answer that? I mean, how did this monumental amount of fossils, where did it come from? In sharp contrast to the virtual lack of fossilization transpiring today, there's an incredible amount of fossilization that occurred sometime in the past. The billions and billions of fossils we find preserved in the fossil record simply could not have been formed by processes observable in the world today, as uniformitarian geologists have assumed and taught. Such preservation is very abnormal, the exception, not the rule. Our global fossil record therefore attests to a strictly atypical, worldwide, cataclysmic, hydraulic water event. The fossil record of the geologic column is not a history of evolving life forms. Now, let me say this. Many of you probably know this. You know what a geological column is? The geological column is maybe that graph or drawing that you've seen in, you know, various publications. What it's about is you start up here, and this way up here is now, right? And there's men, you know, but we're up here now, and we're full blood, you know, men and all that. And you go down, and you know, as of 1.6 million years ago, we were really apes. And you proceed down this, you know, down this column, and you finally get down here to 500. That was not very good. 570 million years ago, and 570 million years ago was the Precambrian era, when there was only one cell organism and so on. You move on up to 530 million years ago, and that was the Cambrian era. And you go on up, and there's the Triassic and the Jurassic and all that kind of stuff, you know. But basically, you go back 570 or 80 million years ago, right? And what the geological column is supposed to be is that if you could find a perfect place on Earth, you should be able to go back and stand in a Grand Canyon type area and look and see all these strata starting way up at the top of the plateau or whatever, going all the way down here, and all the way down here you hit igneous rock, you know, lava type rock, but all the way up through here is sedimentary rock, and what you see in there is fossils. And you start the bottom and you see little one cell organisms, and you gradually work up this way, and you get to the hard-shelled organisms, and you work up this way, and you come up to amphibians eventually, and on up here, and finally you come to monkeys, and, you know, well, you know, the dinosaurs are in here, and then the monkeys are in here, and then we finally become man. In other words, ideally, you should be able to find a place on this earth where all these rocks are laid in order, and these fossils are just perfectly laid out with the one-cell organisms down here, gradually work up to shellfish, gradually work up to you know, amphibians, gradually work up to dinosaurs, and then you eventually get birds, because the dinosaurs developed feathers, you know, they jumped out of trees for so long they developed feathers, and, you know, right on up, you know, to monkeys and so on and so forth. There's only one problem with that whole stinking mess. There is no geological column. The whole stinking mess, it's all theory. And you say, well, how did they get that? Well, what they said was, well, we know that we all began as you know, well, let's just go back to shellfish. And we know that these shellfish in this rock strata right here are from 480 million years ago. I'm not sure that that's true. 400 million years ago. Well, how do you know that? Because it's in that rock strata. Well, how do you know that the rock strata is that old? Because that fossil's in there. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Brother, that is exactly what they used to say. That's circular reasoning. Exactly. They say, that rock strata is that old because we know that fossil lived back there. Well, how do you know how old that fossil is? Because that's the rock strata it's in. That's it. The interesting thing about that, I probably should wait and read it to you, but nowhere on this earth are those rock strata laid out like that. Nowhere. They are, in some cases, shuffled. In some cases, they're inverted to some degree or another. And I'll read some more about it in a minute, but suffice to say that one of the explanations that it would equal, and this does happen, by the way. I mean, if you go to the Grand Canyon and various other places where, you know, you can see the sedimentary rock strata, you do find, well, at the bottom, you do find, you know, well, shellfish and so on, and then you work on up and you do, but by the way, it is reasonable that in a worldwide flood, that is hydraulically, they've proven this, by the way, hydraulically, how organisms would shift out. I mean, it follows that one-celled organisms and shellfish would probably be buried at the bottom because they can't move. And that the fish would essentially then be killed, and then something that is actually able to get out on land and run, for probably the bigger mammals and animals would wind up being closer to the top because they would have the ability to move faster. So the bottom line is where you do find something that resembles this, even in nature, it's not a testament to millions of years of evolutionary development. It's actually a testament as much as anything else to a worldwide flood, and that's how things sifted out. Again, how does a 5 or 10 ton, whatever they are, Allosaurus or Stegosaurus, die and get encased in rock? All right. So, again, the fossil records. Evolutionists insist that the progression of life forms found in the fossil record from simple to complex prove the evolutionary progression of life. However, it should be expected from the hydraulic sorting action of a worldwide cataclysm in the same way. Creationists reason that the progression from marine invertebrates to fishes to amphibians to reptiles to mammals up the column basically involves their ability to escape death and destruction in the Genesis flood. Another interesting thing. One of the things that speaks against evolution as such, and for, by the way, the flood, is something called fossil graveyards. There are caves, fissures, and mass burial sites throughout the world that are literally packed with masses of fossils. Oftentimes, the fossils of these various animals come from widely separated and differing climatic zones, only to be thrown together in disorderly masses. In other words, you have caves and fissures and holes. One place, for instance, is in Maryland, where there is just animal on top of animal on top of animal on top of animal, just you know, fossil just piled up in there. And they come from everything from polar bears and grizzly bears to wolverines to tropical type, you know, animals and that kind of thing. And what that seems to speak of, it's not a evolutionary event at all. It's things being, first of all, herded together, dying, and then washing around. And eventually, by means of, ocean currents, duh. Because of currents, they all filter down into these places, you know, and get stuck and bottleneck. And so you just wind up with these piles of things, everything from fish to mammals to reptiles to elephants to everything in the world in there. For example, consider Cumberland Cavern in Maryland. It contains the remains of various animals from warm, damp, semi-tropical areas and so on and so forth. Uniformitarian principles utterly fail to offer any explanation for such bizarre conditions. These tremendous fossil graveyards and mass burial sites can only be correctly understood in terms of Bible catastrophism. Okay, there's another interesting thing. I don't know if I have ever heard this anywhere. I mean, I've never been a habitual watcher of the Discovery Channel or Animal Planet or anything, and so I don't know if they've ever testified to this before or not, but I rather imagine in the times that I have seen what little I've seen, it's never been mentioned. Did you know that there is in Siberia and Alaska the existence of an estimated 5 million frozen solid mammoths, whole. Further startling evidence of the fact that a great and sudden cataclysm once struck the earth is found in the millions of mammoths and other large animals that were killed instantly in the North Polar regions, Siberia and Alaska. Many of these have been found preserved whole and undamaged, except for being dead, of course, with flesh and hair intact, and in some cases, either kneeling or standing upright with food on their tongues. Now, you know, not only did they all die together, and not only were they all preserved together, brother, they were frozen instantaneously, such to be able to preserve the food that was in their mouth and in their gut. Wow. Right? The eyes and red blood cells were found to be extremely well preserved. The separation of water in the cells was only partial, which speaks of extremely sudden and sustained freezing conditions. All uniformitarian explanations fail dismally. Charles Lyell, 19th century champion of uniformitarianism, evolutionist, was aware of the problem and recognized the seriousness of the threat to his theory. Charles Darwin was also aware of the mammoth and confessed that he saw no solution to it. Now, basically, creationists propose that, if you remember, Adam and Eve were living to 900 plus years, as all those folks did back then, and then there was the flood, and subsequently after the flood, everybody's lifespans real quickly shortened down to, you know, Abraham's 120 years, Moses 120 years, and by the time you reach David, you know, 70, basically. Well, one of the theories is that there was some sort of a canopy around the earth, and there's some indication in the scripture that it didn't rain until Noah's flood. That it was, what do you call those things that you put water in, but it, you know, it sustains life? Terrarium. I can never think of the name. But basically like a terrarium where you have an enclosed type system where there's so much water in there and it basically waters the ground. There's sufficient water to sustain life and all that without it actually raining. Okay, so the rain in Noah's day was really something special. But that when it happened, the fountains of the great deep were opened up, and there are various theories on what actually happened. But that, if there are mammoths in northern Siberia with green tropical foliage in their mouths, then Siberia is different today than it was then. Evidently, it was a tropical climate all over. And so the idea is there's some sort of a vapor canopy or an ice canopy that got busted up, and the temperatures immediately fell, in some cases, to sufficient to freeze a 10-ton mammoth, basically instantaneously. They're estimating, you know, 150 degrees below, that kind of stuff. Well, I don't know about that being true, but I know that there are 5 million plus mammoths up there. How do you explain that? And let me ask you, how many ever heard that outside of picking up a book and reading creationist material? How many of you ever, found that, you know, in a museum somewhere or on the Discovery Channel or Animal Planet or some such thing like that? I never did. Admittedly, I haven't watched much and not gonna. But, you know, how many ever really heard that? Why don't they say something about that? They present evolution as a fact and leave the rest of the evidence aside. Interesting. Furthermore, extinctions. For many years, evolutionists have been baffled by the fact that strong, well-established groups of animals, such as dinosaurs, suddenly disappear from the fossil record. Although their sudden disappearance or departure puzzles evolutionists, creationists simply attribute their misfortune either directly or indirectly to the Genesis flood. Okay, how is it possible that these allosaurs and Tyrannosaurus rexes or whatever suddenly just disappear? They're just gone. Got these, what do they call them, brontosaurs? They used to call them brontosaurs, they call them something else now. Those gigantic 200-ton something or another's, you know. Why did they just go away? You say it was a glacial action. They just disappeared in one day. They were just completely overrun by the glacier. Dinosaurs may be slow, but they're not that slow. You understand? How can this, how can this be? Furthermore, everybody's heard of petrified forest, right? Petrified things. Did you know that as such, it's called petrifaction. Petrifaction is not occurring today, at least on a large scale. Now, by the way, it is this petrifaction thing. This was supposed to, you know, happen over a long period of time, but they have actually, with the Mount St. Helens disaster and some other things, seen some things. Mount St. Helens was a coup for creationists, believe it or not. And among other things, what they found at time, they have found petrified hats and various other things that prove that petrifaction can occur under the right circumstances. But petrifaction is, by the way, I just got through teaching my boys this in science. So petrifaction is where the inorganic or organic material, wood, or even for that matter, bone and meat, is actually replaced by minerals. I mean, it is actually the replacement due to water and much water and much mineral in the water, where before it can degrade and decompose, the tissues of either the body or wood or whatever is actually replaced by essentially stone. Now, you have petrified logs. Petrified logs present a troublesome enigma for uniformitarian. That is, the only place that you can really substantiate petrifaction is a extraordinary conditions in which an extraordinary amount of water suddenly rises with an extraordinary amount of mineral in it, and over a short period, the petrifaction occurs. But as far as a process you look around at today, it's not happening. They do, however, occur by the thousands in the fossil records, having their fibers and cell structure perfectly preserved by replacement of silica. All the evidence concerning these logs points to a sudden and catastrophic event. None of these logs are found to be standing. All have had their branches stripped off, and many appear to have had their bark still intact, indicating rapid burial before rotting could occur. It is apparent that the original forests were uprooted by some sort of hydraulic cataclysm of enormous power, which also transported, deposited them in their present locations, where they become petrified under unique conditions. Creationists submit that the only reasonable and plausible explanation for such a phenomenon is the Genesis flood. Did you know, by the way, speaking of trees, that there is something called polystratic trees? And polystratic tree simply means that in the geological column, covering, from here to here is many millions of years, tens of millions of years, that in the geological column, you often will have a 20 to 30 foot tree standing upright. But understand that each one of these layers and all these little sub-layers and sub-layers took millions and millions of years to lay down, one at a time. So from the time you move from this tree from here to here, that tree stood there for 100 million years. Just doesn't work. Just doesn't work. Soft parts, by the way. There are numerous cases of preservation of actual soft part, that is tissue, Not bone, not shell, in the fossil record. This is true even in what is presumed to be the most ancient of strata. Such fossils are commonly discovered together in large masses. One of the most remarkable examples of this is in the fossil graveyard in Geiseltal, central Germany. More than 6,000 remains of vertebrate animals and a great number of insects, mollusks, and plants were found into the deposits. The compressed remains of soft tissues of many of these animals showed details of cellular structure, and some of the specimens had undergone but little chemical modification. How do you do that? Folks, tissue rots. I mean, all you got to do is leave a dead rat lay around for a day in the sun, and you learn that tissue rots. How does that happen? How does it become a fossil? Such remarkable deposits could not have been formed by normal, slow, uniformitarian processes. By the way, one of the things that's interesting about the that you find is something called erratic boulders. That is, you have rocks. Sometimes they're the size of houses. Sometimes they're the size of cars. Sometimes larger. And there are these boulders are laying out in in the center of geological places. Open. There is no rock like them anywhere within hundreds of miles. Those boulders were transported by something. Now, you know what's been proven? It's proven that water can transport. If you've ever seen any kind of film footage of flash floods, and some, flash floods many times in those little canyons and so on, I mean, you're talking about 10 feet of water, 20 feet of water, rolling boulders and logs in front of it, I mean, boulders the size of, the size of a man, bigger than a man. Well, let's say that it started raining a foot an hour right now at a rate like that. Can you imagine the size of some of the waves and so-called, flash floods that would occur, and how big a rock could they move? There's one. Let me sort through some more of this. Like I said, the point is that there's more evidence for Noah's flood than there is for evolution as a whole. Among other things, volcanism, volcanic stuff, igneous rocks. Igneous rock is what comes out of volcanoes. Millions of square miles of these, thousands of feet deep, are found all over the world. No volcano ever known to man has produced anything like this quantity of lava. So it must have been produced by a process not repeated and not observed. I mean, where are lava deposits forming that are making entire mountain ranges and plateaus now? Where in this world today are there mountain ranges being formed? I mean, we have earthquakes, but they still don't make mountains. I mean, you have a volcanic rock at times miles deep, miles in the air. How does that work? Continental ice sheets. According to some geologists, 4 million square miles of North America and 2 million square miles of Europe were once glaciated. There have been 29 plus explanations of this put forward, but every one has been found untenable in the light of further information. Where did glaciers come from and why did they go back away? Coal beds. What's coal? Coal is masses of vegetation. Carbon, organic material laid down in masses and compressed extraordinarily with great heat. What's uniformitarian about that? How do you kill entire forests, entire layers of vegetation, compress it immediately before it can degrade and decompose? How does that happen without a cataclysm? And why do you find great thick veins of coal throughout the world? How does that work? Uniformitarian geology. It doesn't work. They really don't offer much of an explanation. I was telling you a minute ago, and I'll be done with this. Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens, what was that, 1980, I think it erupted from May 15th or 18th on through October or something like that. You know what they discovered? They discovered that at Mount St. Helens, that first of all, gigantic amounts, layer upon layer, strata upon strata of sedimentary rock in which fossils are found can be laid down in mere days, weeks, and months. And I've got a picture at home in the boys' textbook of a woman, a geologist, standing there, and behind her rises this serrated, stratified wall of rock, 3 to 4 times her height. It can happen in a period of months. They show a canyon that was formed. Looks a whole lot like Grand Canyon, 1/40th the size of Grand Canyon out in Washington. And it formed in a period of mere weeks from the masses of volcanic ash coupled with the steam, coupled with the rain and all that kind of stuff that came down through there, completely eroded it away. Guess what happened? They say what? In the Grand Canyon, that the Colorado River, through hundreds of millions of years, gradually eroded away the Grand Canyon. Did you know that in the canyon at Mount St. Helens, beside Mount St. Helens, that there was no river there before? That the canyon formed, and then there was a river at the bottom. It's kind of interesting, huh? Well, so folks, my point is that, you know, as far as we're concerned, I mean, the Lord just approaches this thing. You know what he says? Jonah is going to be a great sign to you guys. And folks just flip out. Well, Jesus said it was a fish. And then, back earlier it said it was a whale. Well, was it? They're not the same. Hey, well, stupid. It might be that God doesn't categorize animals according to your classification system. It might be that God would distinguish a whale as a fish, even though scientists wouldn't. They find it's a joke. I mean, come on. A worldwide flood, waters above the mountains, and yet that's the evidence that's here. They just don't tell you that. So anyway, any questions or comments? Yeah, Paul? Well, it's good. And I hesitate to bring it up because it's controversial, but I mean, any creationist scientist can point to Noah's flood as the root and stem of all this geological, fossil record, the so-called, geological column and all that. Truth of the matter is, now look, I'm not going to throw it at you this morning because there's not enough time, but I'm one of those guys, I believe in the gap. Okay, I believe scripturally, and I believe not because I prefer it, but I believe because the Bible teaches it, that there was a gap, that there was another flood even prior to Noah's flood, there are several things that, by the way, answers that are preferable to dinosaurs being on the ark. And there are some answers that it provides. Well, there are some answers that, I've heard that theory, and I understand, but furthermore, it provides some answers about the fall of Satan that really is not provided if you believe that the only flood that there was Noah's flood. But my point merely being that, and by the way, one of the things that Morris always throws up, Morris is in the camp that's absolutely anti-gap, is what he always throws up is the idea that, well, what gap theorists, and I believe it's a gap doctrine, by the way, that what gap theorists are trying to justify is millions of years of a geological record. That's not what I'm trying to justify at all. I don't believe that there's millions of years of geological record, but I do believe there was two floods. And I believe that everything doesn't have to necessarily be attributable to even Noah's flood, because there was one even before that. But like I said, I'll spare you the exposition on that. We can cover it later because it'll take a little while to go through. But suffice to say, if there's even two floods, well, that makes for even a lot more room. Yes, sir.
Baffles beyond human reason the way that so-called Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual leader.
Yes, sir, it is.
We should actually include Darwinism as one of the world's great religions.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Well, the important thing that we do, I mean, let's face it, I mean, the first thing the devil had to do was get rid of the Word of God. Yea, hath God said. And then the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. It's important that man gets rid of God, because if there's a God, then God's going to judge him. And he's not an animal. So man just simply stamps his pink little feet and says, I am an animal. Therefore, he's not going to be judged, right? But he is going to be judged. He is going to be judged. All right, yes, sir. I heard that he did. I read that he did. That he was uncomfortable with parts of it. But you find that a lot. I mean, folks, I mean, you find a lot of times that these guys that set forth these theories, that everybody jumps on that bandwagon. A lot of times they were less adamant in their theories than their followers are, you know. But I did hear that Darwin recanted. I mean, it's just like Dr. Spock backed away from all the junk that he had taught through the years, you know. When he, well, it's amazing. Like I said, I mean, man sets forth this geological column, this classification system for living organisms, and demands that God puts them in slots just like he did. I mean, whales are not fish. Whales are mammals. Right? And so if God says in one place it's a fish and then calls it a whale, well, God must be stupid. But you see that the same thing. You see that it bleeds over into the Bible issue. I mean, man thinks that God must do grammatically, follow man's grammatical rules. He doesn't have to. God can use a double superlative if he wants to. What's the most? Oh, Paul said, I'm a member of the most straightest sect of the Nazarenes. My grammar teachers from junior high school and high school would crucify me upside down if I said most straightest. But Paul did, and the Lord inspired it. So what's it mean? It means that God doesn't follow our rules.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled it down. Interesting. I was going to say in that science book that I was the boys' science book, it has a panoramic picture of the devastation of Mount St. Helens, and there is one canyon it's called the Engineers Canyon, and it was naturally formed, you know, not cataclysmically formed, and then just, you know, a quarter of a mile, half mile, whatever to whatever north, south, east, or west of it is a parallel canyon that was formed with all the muck that came out of Mount St. Helens. And, you know, it's actually bigger than the original canyon. It's just interesting. Like I said, the whole thing about that one is, the river showed up after the devastation, not even at the beginning. So it'd just be hilarious for God, you know, at judgment to be able to point to this whole geological column stuff and say, you guys got everything backwards, you know? It's really, I mean, God hath made foolish the wisdom of this world. Brother Steve? Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know. Did you see that? I didn't get a chance to read it carefully. It's been crazy this week with my wife gone. They said that my wife gets some news items from homeschool groups and that kind of stuff. And they have currently found an allosaur. I mean, basically, did they come before Tyrannosaurus or after? I don't know. Anyway, it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex, only it's called an allosaur now. And they evidently found it's supposedly one of the biggest they've ever found, and so on. And it's being excavated almost completely by creationists. So they're really, you know, thumping on this one. It's going to be interesting to kind of see what comes out of it, although I don't keep up that much with the creationist material. But. There have been some interesting theories, but like I said, even, you know, with, you know, believing what I believe about God replenishing the earth, not only after Noah's flood, but in Abraham's day, replenish. And believing what I believe about 2 Peter, you know, the whole thing is the dinosaurs could have easily been here during that. I mean, they, in the Paluxy Riverbed in Texas, they find dinosaur footprints. I mean, how do you preserve a footprint? I'm sorry. I mean, you know, you go out, walk in the mud, and see how long it takes for the footprint to disappear. They find in the dinosaur footprints in the riverbed in Texas a large man's footprint in the dinosaur footprint. Okay. I was going to do more, but we'll better close. Anything else? Okay, we'll close and have church here shortly.